Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And it just dawned on me, I have not posted last week's shows yet and conversations and so forth for the different patriot groups we're working with. And so forgive me, folks. I'll try to get on that by this weekend to get this week and last week's up, since, you know, this stuff is important. I mean, we're providing you the content so that as you're driving along, you can actually read or you know, listen along as we read for you to digest, you know, how they were defining the Constitution, because this all translated. Now, we're giving you some of the early understandings. They have not pounded this all out. What we're really showing you is the cumbersome process of how they wanted to stitch together the significant changes to meet the exigencies. Remember, we already provided you the 7 or 8 amendments that there were, and actually I posted those. So you can go read the amendments to the Articles of Confederation so you can see how defunct it was and how they were forced to have to make significant changes, right? I mean, when you look at all of those, the administrative amendments, we got Paul with us. Isn't that correct, Paul? I mean, when we looked at all those amendments, that was some significant changes.
They were.
Okay. And so
they were significant enough that they felt they needed a convention to do something about it.
That is correct. And so I believe that it's not that these men were really going dangerously awry or abandoning their responsibility. As a matter of fact, the farthest thing from it, there was really no accusations as to, you're trying to, you know, this is a conspiracy against the Confederacy. Nothing like that. Many of these men may have brought up that, you know, we're venturing in an area that, you know, is outside the commission. And I believe it has been brought up that, and that's why I think Patterson read the commission or the fundamental commission of this convention when he was providing this plan.
Yes.
Right. And it was to make, you know, significant changes. And then Sherman comes along and says, well, let's take the best of both of these worlds. And voila. I mean, and actually, it really wasn't an aha moment until later. But what we're in the process of is going through what Roger Sherman submitted as the compromise. Mm-hmm. And it set the stage for, you know, the King Almighty, Alexander Hamilton, to basically inject his plan or what he thought this new federal government should be. And, you know, I'm not sure if Madison captured it. It doesn't seem like he did, you know, all of the, you know, comments from the peanut gallery.
Okay.
But anyway, if you remember where we left off, we were talking about coins, currencies, and so forth. Is there something I'm missing?
I don't think so far, but I'm trying to. The question that I didn't get to ask as we were closing up yesterday was, if states are not allowed to pass anything but gold and silver as payment of debts, you know, then why do they need to pass legal tender laws? In other words, why don't they just follow the Constitution, which, by the way, if they did, they wouldn't be using worthless green, you know, greenback paper rectangles.
Well, right. But the federal government said, so it all started around the 1850s or sometime after that, where the federal government started creating greenbacks or what have you. And that's what they were called. And everybody saw them as worthless unless you could get yourself to a bank. Now let's look at this. The majority of the American people may have been living in the city areas where this was reachable. But all of these new states that were coming, there was a small, they were, I mean, I guess as you formed to the West Coast of the 1890s, right? That's when most of the states had formed. Oklahoma had, there's still a few states that hadn't. But as we look at California, the population of California was just nothing because, the, you know, the gold rush had started. That's all that was out there. And so maybe they had banks there. But when you look at where you could turn a greenback into gold or silver, was really hard to find in most of rural America. You had to go out of your way. It was worthless to them. And because a lot of people wouldn't take it. Why? Because now all I have is paper, and I, you know, I have to go all this way to go and exchange it for gold and silver, if that's what you want.
Right.
So people who were showing up with this greenback and saying, hey, you know, this is the same thing. You know, news travels slowly, especially in those days. And, you know, I'm sure if it traveled maybe even slower than the greenback itself. And so people go, what the heck is this? So there was a big rejection after everybody started really appreciating this gold and silver that the federal government was coming out with a paper that was exchangeable for gold and silver.
Okay.
And that was the standard up until the 1900s, where FDR and Wilson, they actually started printing money. And I'm not sure that they were keeping track whether there was enough gold and silver for exchanging.
I think they weren't. And I think that was the plan.
And the exchanging laws basically started getting set aside. And eventually, they started actually printing paper that was no longer notes. In other words, notes that were backed by gold and silver. And that actually happened under Nixon, where Nixon was the one that took away the exchangeability of paper money for gold and silver completely. They were already printing some of that money, but they were no longer printing the certificates or anything like that. And they were taking the certificates out of circulation.
Completely and unilaterally.
Yes.
Did he even have the authority to do that?
Well,
or did we do it just because we believed he
was president? So he had the authority unconstitutionally. You got to remember that that's how you have to say it. Congress told him to go ahead and do it. But Congress did not have the constitutional authority to give him that order.
Right.
Okay, so, you know, when we look at all of these things, every time people point to the corporations, the government corporations, the courts and so forth, and what, you know, what they're doing, that doesn't mean that it was constitutionally created. It didn't mean that they had the constitutional authority to do these things. They just started doing things. They were make. It's just like, you know, what a kid would say out in the play yard. Oh, you're just making it up as you go along.
Right.
And that's what the federal government's been doing. And in some cases, it's not as whimsical as we thought it might have been. We're actually finding that how, you know, many of these changes that they were invoking unconstitutionally were, you know, wow. I mean, they kind of led to really nefarious things. Who would have thunk? Unless you understood the architect of this entire direction, the way we were going. And it wasn't any man living.
Right.
Lucifer was actually the one that was, you know, the...
directing?
Well, what do you call that? The big puppeteer, the guy that, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
the marionette or the, you know, whatever you call that guy behind this curtain of all these different puppeteers. He's like the coordinator. He's like the orchestrator, whatever.
Right.
So anyway, we're going through the notes on the Madison's notes, specifically his notes on the Constitutional Convention. And so where we left off was in the Sherman Plan. We got, you know, partially through this, maybe halfway or so. And so we're at the point of that the eighth article of the Confederation ought to be amended agreeably to the recommendation of Congress of the blank day of blank.
And I guess below here, they're going to repeat the eighth article, right?
Well, I don't know. Let's just keep going, though.
Okay. That if any state shall refuse or neglect to furnish its quota of supplies upon requisition made by the legislature of the United States, agreeable to the Articles of the Union, that the said legislature be authorized to order the same to be levied and collected of the inhabitants of such state, and to make such rules and orders as may be necessary for that purpose. So if the state doesn't pay, then the federal government will tax the inhabitants?
That's what it's saying.
That's interesting.
That is. So this, they're forming these ideas, right, of how to do these things, because they knew it was critical that the Continental Congress had the ability to extract a pound of flesh out of the states.
Okay.
Okay.
That the legislature of the United States have power to make laws calling forth such aid from the people from time to time as may be necessary to assist the civil officers in the execution of the laws of the United States and annex suitable penalties to be inflicted in case of disobedience. Ooh.
Yeah. Okay. And?
And that no person shall be liable to be tried for any criminal offense committed within any of the United States in any other state than that wherein the offense shall be committed, nor be deprived of the privilege of trial by jury by virtue of any law of the United States.
Okay. And then they adjourned.
Okay.
So notice that that was the last thing stated from the New Jersey plan, and then Sherman kind of got up and said, well, let me offer this kind of bridge that we can do these things. Okay. Now, what ended up happening was Mr. Lansing, and he, by the way, is the Anti-Federalist.
Okay.
From New York. And so what ends up happening the next day, June 16th, Mr. Lansing comes in and he pulls the punk card. And says, hey, hold on here. We're not following the commission.
Oh, is that what he said?
Yeah, okay. Because that's what you're going to find here. And so go ahead and, take it from,
okay,
from the
so
top.
Okay, so this is Saturday, June 16, 1787, Mr. Lansing in the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Lansing, commission called for the reading of the first resolution of each plan, which he considered as involving principles directly in contrast. That of Mr. Patterson says he sustains the sovereignty of the respective states, that of Mr. Randolph destroys it. The latter requires a negative on all the laws of the particular states, the former only certain general powers for the general good. The plan of Mr. Randolph, in short, absorbs all power except what may be exercised in that little local matters of the states which are not objects worthy of the supreme cognizance. He grounded his preference on Mr. Patterson's plan chiefly on two objects against that of Mr. Randolph. One, want of power in the convention to discuss and propose it. Two, the improbability of its being adopted. So, number one, he was decidedly of the opinion that the power of the convention was restrained to amendments of a federal nature and having for their basis the Confederacy in being. The act of Congress, the tenor of the acts of the states, the commissions produced by the several deputations all proved this. And this limitation of the power to an amendment of the Confederacy marked the opinion of the states that it was unnecessary and improper to go farther. He was sure that this was the case with his state. New York would never have concurred in sending deputies to the convention if she had supposed the deliberations were to turn on a consolidation of the states and a national government. Two, was it probable that the states would adopt and ratify a scheme which they had never authorized us to propose, and which so far exceeded what they regarded as sufficient? We see by their several acts, particularly in relation to the plan of revenue proposed by Congress in 1783, not authorized by the Articles of Confederation, what were the ideas they then entertained? Can so great an exchange be supposed to have already taken place? To rely on any change which is hereafter to take place in the sentiments of the people would be trusting to too great an uncertainty. We know only what their present sentiments are, and it is in vain to propose what will not accord with these. The states will never feel a sufficient confidence in a general government to give it a negative on their laws. The scheme is itself totally novel. There's no parallel to it to be found. The authority of Congress is familiar to the people, and an augmentation of the powers of Congress will be readily approved by them.
Okay, so let's stop here.
Okay.
Because I think that's what you want to do, and that's what I want to do.
Okay.
So we have read the amendments to the Articles of Confederation.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that changes is the makeup that seems to be outside those amendments is to actually convert Congress or the Continental Congress into three separate bodies, because clearly Congress had no federal court.
Right.
They convened a court on call as necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But, and one of the things that was not in the amendments, because one of the things that they hadn't tripped across yet was that as this government started actually engaging and doing more and more regarding commerce and so forth, don't you think a federal court would have been necessary? Mm-hmm. Not this, let's patch together a court for this one and patch together a court for that case. In other words, having a Supreme Court in dealing with international issues and international problems, legal problems with other courts. And so my point is that these men kind of realized that the limitations that were placed upon the magistrate of Congress, that there was really no executive. Who was the executive? John Hancock was one of the executives of Continental Congress, but he was an administrative executive of the body, not of the states. And it's the same thing. Everything was administrative of, doing things, but it was not they didn't have a true general government. It was lipstick on a pig. Continental Congress and what they called a general government was lipstick on a pig, and every nation in the world recognized it. They had no ability to actually get anything out of the states, and Lansing was actually thwarting the possibility of giving this general government limited and defined powers so that it could function and pay its debt.
Okay.
And so they weren't talking about national health care. They weren't talking about a national roadway system. They weren't talking about controlling labor. They weren't talking about controlling every aspect of our lives that the federal government has. They were only saying that they have to conduct war. They have to regulate commerce. They have to do these very few things for us, that they create these standards, that they create a currency standard. And again, I'm asking you, other than the judiciary and the executive, in other words, dealing with the magistrate itself, which was basically a brainchild of Madison in the Virginia plan of actually, creating the three separate branches and dividing up the magistrate. So help me out here. Were they really going out and creating this, national government that had all powers?
No.
No, not at all. So what was Lansing really doing?
So
I think he was being a drama queen, in actually saying, I perceive that we've exceeded, because it's beautiful that actually Patterson starts off his plan with this.
Uh-huh.
And Patterson basically says at the very beginning, right here, he says that it's the very first resolution that the Articles of Confederation ought to be so revised, corrected, and enlarged as to render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. And so whatever they needed to do to enlarge, and a part of that was actually creating, because one of the things that Lansing didn't see, and it wasn't put on the table yet, because we haven't even talked about checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
And the beautiful thing about having these checks and balances between the three branches, that was something that, you know, they fell, forgive the expression, back-asswards into.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they go, you know, in doing this, wow, look at these things that we'll benefit from. By enlarging, or actually by dividing the roles and responsibilities of the magistrate into three separate branches. Right. So, anyway, so back to, where are we? So we're going into what Mr. Patterson is going to basically respond. But go ahead. I'll let you make your point.
I was just remarking. I said this. How Mr. Lansing started. Tell me if I'm wrong. That this is one of the statements that people claim we had a runaway convention.
There you go.
Go to.
Absolutely. Now, he didn't make the assertion that, hey, you know, you guys have, you know, you're crazy. Where did we get the authority to do any of this? He wasn't making that accusation.
Right.
He was basically saying that we're wandering outside. But he did not read that commission as Mr. Patterson did.
Right. Okay. So we're back to Mr. Patterson.
Because
right.
basically what he's basically talking about is we have to keep this Continental Congress and their powers so that they have no force over the states. That's what we're supposed to do here, right? No. Because did we not see an amendment that was going to give Continental Congress coercive powers over both the states and the people?
Mm-hmm.
That was an amendment. So what he's basically saying, and this whole thing that, oh, well, this is a bad thing. The reason anybody points to the Constitutional Convention as a runaway convention is a piss poor excuse as to why, you know, we should not even be talking about an Article 5 convention. We shouldn't be talking about it. The Constitution is not the problem. Back then, the Articles of Confederation were the problem. That was the problem du jour, and we were going to basically be taken over. We were at the cusp of that happening, whether they knew it or not. The revolution in France would have caused that because we were not able to pay France.
So our timing was actually providential.
That's right. That's
wow.
right. And it just annoys me that any group out there, whether it be members of the Eagle Forum or leadership of the John Birch Society, want to hang their flag on the fact that these guys were out of scope and a runaway convention. No way. They were constantly being reminded by these dolts like Lansing saying, oh, well, you know, we can't give this government the powers that you're talking about. No, that's exactly why they were meeting, was to give them those powers. To meet the exigencies of the Union, to preserve the Union. If we would have listened and they followed what everybody preaches was, you know, focusing on the Articles of Confederation, what these anti-federals were saying, that we would have been destroyed, period.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would never have created this Constitution.
Yeah.
And that's the truth. And I can't believe that, you know, anybody out there, you know, listens to the argument that this was a runaway convention and not call them out on it. You know, why is it that so many people embrace this and actually regurgitate that? That is just so repugnant to me. Anyway, we're at a hard break. So when we come back, we're going to listen to some now the discourse of, you know, this focus on what are we supposed to be doing here. And so we'll let Mr. Matteson and some other following comments. Let's go.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I wanted to get back into this discourse that I forgot that we were actually going into a break and not coming back from one. So my bad. I actually, when I muted myself, I had to laugh a little bit. So anyway, because, you know, this is really important. And people, it seems like I take it personal when people take a stab at the Constitution, right?
Yeah.
I come off that way, and they're right. I do take it personal, and so if we allow people to denigrate and sully this Constitution, then we're only paving a way for the progressives to actually say we got to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And anybody that says anything other than that this is truly, you know, a form of governing that we have yet to begun to tap on what mm-hmm. the potential of America truly is, because we have failed this Constitution, because we should never have engaged in the UN. We should have basically started telling every nation out there, you know, if you don't want to be, you know, thrown to and from the despots of tyranny and democracy, then you need to join this union.
Mm-hmm.
And when World War II came along, World War I, you know, and some of the other skirmishes and so forth, as, you know, we went to nations' rescues for the past two centuries.
Right.
We should have basically said, we will only engage if you're seeking to become a state in this United States.
Okay.
Okay, anyway. So Mr. Patterson does a retort, his reply. Go ahead.
You say he doesn't retort?
No, he does a retort.
Okay. Mr. Patterson said, as he had on a former occasion, given his sentiments on the plan proposed by Mr. Randolph, he would now avoid repetition as much as possible, give his reasons in favor of that proposed by himself. He preferred it because it accorded, one, with the powers of the convention, two, with the sentiments of the people. If the Confederacy was radically wrong, let us return to our states and obtain larger powers, not assume them of ourselves. I came here not to speak my own sentiments, but the sentiments of those who sent me. Our object is not such a government as may be best in itself, but such a one as our constituents have authorized us to prepare, and as they will approve. If we argue the matter on the supposition that no Confederacy at present exists, it cannot be denied that all the states stand on the footing of equal sovereignty. All, therefore, must concur before any can be bound. If a proportional representation be right, why do we not vote so here? If we argue on the fact that a federal compact actually exists and consult the articles of it, we still find an equal sovereignty to be the basis of it. He reads the fifth article of Confederation giving each state a vote, and the 13th declaring that no alteration shall be made without unanimous consent. This is the nature of all treaties. What is unanimously done must be unanimously undone. It was observed by Mr. Wilson that the larger states gave up the point not because it was right, but because the circumstances of the moment urged the concession. Be it so, are they for that reason at liberty to take it back? Can the donor resume his gift without the consent of the donee? The doctrine may be convenient, but it is a doctrine that will sacrifice the lesser states. The large states acceded readily to the Confederacy. It was the small ones that came in reluctantly and slowly. New Jersey and Maryland were the two last, the former objecting to the want of power in Congress over trade, both of them to the want of power to appropriate the vacant territory to the benefit of the whole. If the sovereignty of the states is to be maintained, the representatives must be drawn immediately from the states, not from the people. And we have no power to vary the idea of equal sovereignty. The only expedient that will cure the difficulty is that of throwing the states into hotchpot.
Hotchpot, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm familiar with that.
It's probably a common phrase of the day.
Yeah, okay. And I'm guessing probably throw them into chaos or something like that. All right?
Uh-huh.
To say that this is impracticable will not make it so. Let it be tried, and we shall see whether the citizens of Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Virginia accede to it. It will be objected that coercion will be impracticable. But will it be more so in one plan than the other? Its efficacy will depend on the quantum of power collected, not on its being drawn from the states or from individuals. And according to his plan, it may be exerted on individuals as well as according. That of Mr. Randolph, a distinct executive and judiciary, also were equally provided by his plan. It is urged that two branches in the legislature are necessary. Why? For the purpose of a check. But the reason of the precaution is not applicable to this case. Within a particular state where party heats prevail, such a check may be necessary. I don't know what party heats, unless he's referring to disagreements.
Okay.
In such a body as Congress, it is less necessary, and besides, the delegations of the different states are checks on each other. Do the people at large complain of Congress? No. What they wish is that Congress may have more power. If the power now proposed be not enough, the people hereafter will make additions to it. With proper powers, Congress will act with more energy and wisdom than the proposed national legislature, being fewer in number and more secreted and refined by the mode of election. The plan of Mr. Randolph will also be enormously expensive, allowing Georgia and Delaware two representatives each in the popular branch. The aggregate number of that branch will be 180. Add to it half as many for the other branch, and you have 270. Members coming once at least a year from the most distant as well as the most central parts of the Republic. In the present deranged state of our finances, can so expansive a system be seriously thought of? By enlarging the powers of Congress, the greatest part of this expense will be saved, and all purposes will be answered. At least a trial ought to be made.
Okay, so he's basically pointing out that there are these problems, but he's actually suggesting that maybe we should actually offer something.
Mm-hmm.
Because bottom line, what they're doing and what they're what basically what Lansing is saying is, we're supposed to amend it, but not amend it.
Yeah. In other words, what does that mean? Okay, we're here to amend it.
So what essentially had to happen, folks, is that this Continental Congress, which was basically an administrative body that had no power, it had to be elevated with certain powers. That was the argument that was constantly being brought out. And the anti-federalists said, no, don't give them those powers. We're going to amend this so that we can move forward. But the only way they could amend it was by giving them their powers. And in giving them their powers, it was only incumbent to create checks and balances, because if you had a single body, it becomes easier to corrupt. It took a long time to corrupt, all of Congress, the legislature, or I should say the Congress, both houses, the court, and the executive.
Right.
And, the executive would change, from one occupant to the next. Mm-hmm. So you could go back and forth. I mean, you can look at the vast difference between Adams and then Jefferson's administration. Limited government to Adams, everything government.
Right.
And going from John Quincy Adams, limited government, somewhat limited government, to, Jackson, big government. So anyway, so Mr. Wilson now, he wants to pipe in and add two cents. Now, just keep in mind that Patterson was from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lansing was from New York. And Patterson pointed out that it's the little states that were very reluctant in joining the Confederation because they saw that, it wasn't in their interest. They wanted, they didn't want these kind of powers. They wanted to be able to maintain their own autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And they started realizing, I think that everybody started realizing that, they just won a war because of the Union, not because of one particular state. And
so,
go ahead.
Just out of curiosity, did any anti-federalists actually propose a plan? They came to the convention.
Right.
They knew what it was for. Did any of them actually?
Well, they didn't know they were anti-federalists until, this new federation, this concept of a hybrid federation. So, when people ask me, what do you mean by a hybrid constitutional republic? A hybrid constitutional republic means that we're not a republic that is a confederation, nor are we a republic that is a federation. I mean, we have granted powers to a federal government, but they're limited. The residual powers are left to the states. So technically, we're more of a confederation than we are a federation. But we do have a federal body that has national powers of coercion over very specific things, but limited to those things only. See, in the old days, once you created a federation, all powers granted were always general powers. We were the first ever to enumerate and limit. So when people were looking at this government, because they saw this ability to tax, they thought, this is an unlimited general powered government. But no, they can only tax to spend money on those things enumerated. And this today is America's greatest problem in not understanding that. Because when people look at taxation being the problem, no, taxation is the result of uncontrolled spending.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They only tax based on what they're spending their money on. So taxation is not the problem. What they're spending their money on is the problem. And had the states back in Wilson's day said, hold on here, you can't spend money on those things. This is why people see the 16th Amendment as this huge albatross, this huge, I'll just say, boat anchor that dragged us down to the abyss. And that's not true. It only changed the form of taxation. It didn't give them the ability to create progressive tax or punitive types of taxation going after those who have make more.
Right.
Now, when we look at the whole concept of spending, the 16th Amendment did not grant the federal government to spend money on what they thought was necessary. They were still tied to the enumerated powers. We could have easily put this in check long before the 16th Amendment. And had we done so, my friends, had we actually been doing this and had we actually been on top of this, they would have obtained the amendments they needed and they would have been able to, because when Wilson was doing amendments, he just went ahead and just passed them himself. And he would have done the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. So I tell you, it was divine providence. It was definitely providence involved and in making sure that we were dumb enough that these illiterates only made the changes that they thought that they needed to get away with it. And they didn't actually do all of the things necessary to, you know, so that we could now frustrate them. Because had they actually granted themselves general powers of spending, and that's what the balanced budget amendment will do.
Mm.
Folks, if you understand anything, you know, when you look at some of these stupid amendments that are out there that the COS has got behind them, the balanced budget amendment will destroy us. Mm. Because it allows them to spend based on revenue and a percentage of the GDP. In other words, it now gives them the ability and can ignore enumerations. In other words, they can't spend money on school. They can't spend money on health care. They can't spend money on roadways and improving highways, waterways, and infrastructure. They can't spend money on labor. They can't spend money on housing. I could go on and on. And if we actually got them to spending money on those few enumerated powers, the taxation would dramatically go down. Well, other than the fact that they say, well, we got this debt. And I'm here to tell you folks that almost every dollar of that debt is accounted to unconstitutional spending. Because if we go through the expenditures of the federal government from the very beginning to today, every year that they started this scam of the 16th Amendment in taxing us, we mm-hmm. always had enough revenue to cover the actual cost of government, even fighting wars. We were covering that. They were just spending more money on their progressive agenda and more, it just seemed like it was just unlimited. There was never a breaking point. And we're getting close to that breaking point today.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I yield, go ahead. Let's read what.
So this is Mr. Wilson now, right?
Yeah. Yep. Go ahead.
Mr. Wilson entered into a contract of the principal points of the two plans. So far, he said, as there had been time to examine the one last proposed. These points were: one, in the Virginia plan, there are two, and in some degree, three branches in the legislature. In the plan from New Jersey, there's to be a single legislature only. Two, representation of the people at large is the basis of the one. The state legislatures, the pillars of the other three. Proportional representation prevails in one, equality of suffrage in the other. Four, a single executive magistrate is at the head of the one, a plurality is held out in the other. Five, in the one, the majority of the people of the U.S. must prevail. In the other, a minority may prevail.
So six. I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm going to go back to four.
Okay.
On the executive magistrate. They were already well aware that this new government was going to separate powers or roles and responsibilities and powers of the magistrate. Because that's why they said a single executive magistrate is the head of the one, a plurality is the head of the other. Now, they didn't even start talking about, but because he didn't mention the executive. I think that the plurality was between the judiciary, because they seem to have got caught up in talking about the courts. And so, go ahead.
Yeah, when they use this term magistrate, I'm guessing they're talking about the courts. Is that right?
Yes. The courts and the legislation. They didn't even bring in the separate, because actually the Virginia plan actually had an executive magistrate as well. Mm-hmm. Well, hold on here. I have to remember if the Virginia plan, I think the Virginia plan included a judiciary and an executive. So there were three. It divided it into three, the way we have it today. I think the New Jersey plan did not address an executive at all. As a matter of fact, the president, like I said, the president of Continental Congress was basically an administrative head.
Right.
He was not the president of the union. He was not the governor. But clearly that was in the Virginia plan, that there would be a national governor or president. Now, so this actually grew, and I'm going to show you later on, folks, it's maybe a week, two or so, we're going to dive into the Electoral College and the choosing of the president and show you how much time they spent in talking about the electors. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Keep going with six.
Okay, so we were at number six. Is that right?
Yep, six.
The national legislature is to make laws in all cases to which the separate states are incompetent. And in place of this, Congress are to have additional power in a few cases only. 7, a negative on the laws of the states in place of this coercion to be substituted. 8, the executive to be removable on impeachment and conviction in one plan, in the other to be removable at the instance of majority of the executives of the states.
Okay, so now he brings in the executive. So I'm thinking that maybe the judiciary wasn't a part of the magistrate.
Okay.
Keep going.
All right. 9, revision of the laws provided for in one, no such check in the other. 10, inferior national tribunals in one, none such in the other. 11, in ye one jurisdiction of national tribunals and extends, etc., an appellate jurisdiction only allowed in the other. In 12, there are here the jurisdiction is to extend to all cases affecting the national peace and harmony. There are a few cases only are marked out. 13, finally, ye ratification is in this to be by the people themselves, in that by the legislative authorities according to the 13th Article of Confederation. With regard to the power of the convention, he conceived himself authorized to conclude nothing but to be at liberty to propose anything. In this particular, he felt himself perfectly indifferent to the two plans. Okay, so Mr. Wilson is first speaking, and then I think this must be a commentary by Madison.
Probably, yeah.
Okay, because it's changed from first person to third person. So here we go. I think he's going back. With regard to the sentiments of the people, he conceived it difficult to know precisely what they are. Those of the particular circle in which one moved were commonly mistaken for the general voice. He could not persuade himself that the state governments and sovereignties were so much the idols of the people, nor national governments so obnoxious to them as we supposed. Why should a national government be unpopular? Has it less dignity? Will each citizen enjoy under it less liberty or protection? Will a citizen of Delaware be disregarded by becoming a citizen of the United States? Where do the people look at present for relief from the evils of which they complain? It is from an internal reform of our governments? No, sir. It is from the national councils that relief is expected. For these reasons, he did not fear that the people would not follow us into a national government. And it will be a further recommendation of Mr. Randolph's plan that it is to be submitted to them and not to the legislatures for ratification.
Okay, so let's stop right there. Now, one of the things I noted, he did not mention Sherman. at all at this, right? He said, before us, we had these two plans. So now what I have to do is I have to take what we read in Sherman's plan and put it actually after all of this, because the notes say that he did it on the 15th. And this is clearly in Madison's notes, the 16th.
Right.
And so I believe that there may have been a miscounting of the days. You know, they didn't have watches and, you know, digital clocks. So he may have, you know, miscounted the days or whatever. But bottom line, it's clear that Sherman's compromise has not been presented.
Okay.
Okay. So, and it's interesting that, did you note other, you know, Madison's notes weren't that clear. So we didn't have everything because I didn't hear them actually talking about this. This plan was to be submitted to the people.
Right.
And it's being stated here that that was Randolph's plan, was instead of actually going back to the state legislatures, we're going to present this plan to the people.
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually hadn't known that either.
Right. Okay. So go ahead. Okay. The next paragraph.
So the word proceeding, right?
Right. Yep.
Proceeding now to the first point on which he had contrasted the two plans, he observed that anxious as he was for some augmentation of the federal powers, it would be with extreme reluctance indeed that he could ever consent to give powers to Congress. He had two reasons, either of which was sufficient. One, Congress as a legislative body does not stand on the people. Two, it is a single body. One, he would not repeat the remarks he had formerly made on the principles of representation. He would only say that an inequality in it has ever been a poison contaminating every branch of government. In Great Britain, where this poison has had a full operation, the security of private rights is owing entirely to the purity of her tribunals of justice, the judges of which are neither appointed nor paid by a venal parliament. The political liberty of that nation, owing to the inequality of representation, is at the mercy of its rulers. He means not to insinuate...
Wait, so Paul, yeah? Let's go ahead and stop right there, because we've got about a minute left.
Oh, okay.
And so, let's go ahead and just hit a return, make that he means as a new paragraph. We'll come back and start that off right there.
Okay.
And so at this point, obviously, Mr. Wilson, and he's of Pennsylvania. Now, New Jersey is a small state. And actually, Patterson was very clear. He said, you know, we were one of the last states to come into this union. And we don't like this idea of a national government. You know, we, the state legislatures. But now Wilson actually changes the tone to say, hey, you know, are we really going to say that the people of your state and the people of our state really care that much, other than where do they seek their, you know, the remedies from, you know, when they have real problems? When we're going to be invaded, where, you know, will they go to the state legislature or would they go to the national government?
Right.
And the propensity is for those types of things to go to the national government. Now, at this point in time, the Confederation is so screwed up that every state is making its own trades and so forth, and that's probably to the disadvantage of the other state. So we'll pick this back up because they're really capturing the state of the Confederacy prior to the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. We need your help, and we're going to be diving more into this because this actually helps set the stage for the ratification debates. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort.
We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.